people have this vision of how rusty, dusty the metals industry is. But, you know, I don't really believe that. I mean, I think that the metals industry is highly discerning about how they spend their money, right? Which is they're not going to get a piece of technology just because. They need to draw a line between the investment and the return, and it's nearly that simple. But I think what, and especially what we're trying to do, and I've said people around in the Brizosphere have heard me say, like, I want to create a world for the metals industry where people look at the technologies and the how considerate the technologies are, right? Like, they look at their job and they're like, I want to go be in the metals industry.
Yeah.
Because they got all these robots and shit going on. And the people there are, and you touched on it earlier, like the family aspect of the industry is crazy. And it's really fabulous. And I think that the technologies that are emerging primarily from within the industries are really being mindful of the dynamics that the people in industry want. Like, they don't want a technology that's going to come decimate their family. They want something that's going to work and really complement what that group is doing. And we hear people like, well, what if we use, you know, Brizos and this, that, and the other? And they're like, what are we going to do with, you know, so-and-so and purchasing, so-and-so, you know, selling? I'm like, well, you would be the first company in the metals industry that's properly staffed. Meaning that I'd be willing to bet that that person has more they're not doing than what they are doing.
Well, yeah.
And so it's not a binary proposition. You know, it's about being choosy. Like, what do you bring in into your world?
Yeah. Well, there's that expression, you know, you're working in the business or you're working on the business. And that probably applies to that aspect of it to some degree, I would think also. And I agree with you. I think people, there's a lot of industries that have kind of been ignored for a long period of time. You know, it's not attractive to do this, that, or whatever. And I would probably lump construction and the metals industry kind of as that, you know. And I think there's a bit of a changing of the tide there for, you know, several reasons. You know, the look, we touched on it earlier before, the money's really damn good.
Yep.
You know, the hurdle to the access to it is fairly low, you know, in regards. The opportunities are everywhere right now. The like I said, the manpower shortage is widely known. So,
yeah,
you know, if you're interested and you've got some amount of drive and a commitment to it, we'll find a place for you. You know, we'll figure out how to get you trained in the right way and, you know, put you to work in a meaningful way.
So the first thing I really hone in on is I want to hear the problem you're solving for the buyer. I want to hear the problem you're solving for the supplier.
Mm-hmm.
First thing, I want to hear the person articulate what that is. Is it discovery? Is it transaction time? Is it price transparency? Is it the ability to compare? Is it a cheaper commission structure that the supplier and, you know, cheaper distribution method for them? Is it, you know, what is it? And does the entrepreneur recognize that it's, that they have to create the value prop for both sides and communicate it separately to them? So that's the first thing I try to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is I ask is, and then within that is, does it sound like show me, I guess the second thing would be, show me how their life is going to be different using the marketplace than what they're doing today. I want to see the steps. How does this actually happen today on the buy side and on the sell side? Show me the as is and the to be.
Sure.
How much time is going to be saved? How much effort is it going to take? Is it a big enough change that someone's going to go, this is a meaningful difference? Is it a need to have or a nice to have for both sides?
That's not an easy question to answer.
No.
If you're on square one.
No, very hard.
And after all these years, that's a question I think I finally got answered probably within the last year, because you really wrestle with that question for a long time.
Yeah.
But Anyway, so you're really asking, that's a domain expertise question.
Yes. Yes, very much a domain expertise question. And by the way, when I see people who don't have the domain expertise, I'm usually going to run.
McKinsey did a report recently about expanded frontiers, and that, you know, some companies that really are looking for creative people in their business, they supplement the normal corporate training with these sort of outdoor adventures. And again, it's a very strong bonding experience. And I do think you have conversations with yourself while you're doing this to say, what am I capable of? Who am I? What difference can I make?
It's remarkable along this journey that with Brizos, that is, you know, we've had stretches that we are right where we want to be, and we've had stretches that were stressful. And it's amazing how many times when I'm going through this, I'll kind of hearken back to a time that was physically strenuous. And if I can make it through that, I can make it through this. And how important that has been, you know, through sports in particular, was starting to feel like a long time ago, but I remember it very well. And, you know, other things since then that were, for some reason, physical stress and rigor translate well to mental fortitude. And just kind of being like, well, and just for me, I only can speak for myself, but for me, I haven't really ever hit a stage of panic doing this. There have been uncomfortable times, but it's never been like, oh my God, because I know that there are things I've done that are considerably more strenuous. You know, I think there are great parallels in those things.
I agree. You had asked earlier about my personal perception about evaluating people for hiring, and I oversimplify this a bit, but I use a car metaphor, and I say you can characterize people as how big their engine is, how tight their transmission is, and how much rubber they have on the road. So the idea of an engine is someone who's just brilliant, just natively brilliant. The element of a tight transmission or a very efficient transmission is to map inputs to outputs, and the tires are the ability to track towards the goal for, you know, kind of not deviate, you know, not slide off the road again in the sense of using your case of hair on fire, making random decisions. So I personally, when I invest in companies, I think about the CEOs on those three dimensions. And again, all these people are smart, so maybe it isn't a fair comparison, but I never say, let's go with the guy or the gal with the biggest engine.
Did that feel like a time in your life where it was like humanity restored kind of moment?
Totally. Totally. You're like, it could have been so, so awful. You could feel so awful. And I think I really didn't, because you just would watch everybody around you and be like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I had a cleaning person in the hospital who saw me feeling so sick and was so sad one time. This is the custodian in the hospital, the person cleaning my room. The next day, all I wanted was rice, because that just would settle my stomach. And I ordered hospital rice, and it was far less than impressive. And she saw it, and she saw the look on my face when I tried it.
Yeah.
And she brought me homemade rice the next day from her house. Like, she went home and brought it. And so you're just like, these are amazing things that, you know, that they get
That's
you
incredible.
Through. Yeah, not yeah. feeling good.
And now it definitely feels, at least to me, that you are the type of person that now you pay that forward because of what people did for you. Because you seem to go through life with a very positive attitude. And I love that.
We are very nice. Most days I am. Because most days. There are definitely days that it gets you and you're just like, I can't do this. But yes, and I do pay it forward. I definitely do. I think you've got to. I think people have done so much for me that you just have to give back.
A residence in this hotel suite place where 8 or 10 of us players were staying, right down the street from the rink, and saw on the TV in the lobby what, you know, one of the towers had been hit, and went back up to my room and, you know, watched this second tower get hit, and then went to practice. You know, it was like, shit, I got to go to practice. I went, and our coach, Don Granato, had family that, you know, worked down at the World Trade Center or in that area in New York. And so everybody was just like really, you know, obviously unsettling moment. Everybody in, for our generation remembers where they were, right?
Absolutely.
And so we didn't have practice that day. And because of my relationship with these other friends of mine at Michigan that were already going through the SEAL process, they were already actually SEALs. I was the younger guy. I was like the youngest one in what we call our Wolverine platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were already going, and I knew they were going downrange, going to war.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through that year, you know, up and down in the minors, doing my thing, working hard. And then, you know, but it was tough knowing that I had guys that were really going to put themselves in harm's way and fight in a real war. And it was hard to.
Here I am pushing a
puck
around.
Here I am, you know, playing hockey, you know. And so I had that little bit of a conflict on, you know, what's important in life. And the next year, same thing was starting with the, you know, the Blackhawks farm team in Norfolk.
So you, different organization.
Different organization, yeah. And St. Louis was really stacked at the time, and they won the President's Trophy, you know, best team in the regular season. And it was just, you know, there's only so much opportunity. And timing's everything, you know.
With, yeah.
And so
the conveyor belt had stopped.
Yeah. So if I was going to have a chance to play more, Chicago would have been a better place, opportunity. And so things were going well. And then they had a trade where they got a bunch of defensemen, and, you know, everybody kind of just starts getting shuffled down, right? So at that point, I kind of had to make a hard decision with myself that, you know, I wanted to go be a SEAL. I was 24. I wasn't getting any younger. And I had to, you know, make my peace with hockey and say I had a really awesome, incredible run. And it was, you know, I wouldn't have changed anything, obviously, with my father, you know, playing. That was, you know, not just my family, what we did. It was not what I did, but it was also my connection with him, too. So it was really hard to step away from that. But I realized that, you know, all good things come to an end. And what are you going to do after? And I felt like I had something else, you know, pretty big and substantial that was, you know, calling me to go do after.
Years later, supply chain finance becomes a huge thing. And it's like, well, man, we were doing that in the 90s and we didn't even think of that as a solution outside of it. I mean, it's beautiful, though, because it's embedded in a process that we control.
Yeah, it's like it's a bit like AI to a degree, which is we just always call that like logic or something. And you're like, well, wow, we were doing that a long time ago. It's just now called this now.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So.
And that's what I'm saying when you said, you know, Cass Information Systems is a fintech, really. I mean, if you think of, our competitors are Trax Technologies, which sells as a fintech. Conservice in the utility space. I mean, companies that are considered fintechs are our competitors on the one side. And they all use banks for payment processing. And then we just happen to compete with them in the fintech side, support the middleware for the fintech to talk to the bank and own the bank.
Okay, so it's probably fair to say that CastPay is then just a kind of this, you guys are getting in line with the digital evolution or how people want to pay bills now and how they want to move money now. This is an offering that you guys got. We're already doing this. Let's just package this up in a certain way that makes it easier to integrate with current day fintech solutions and so forth.
That doesn't happen quite as frequently as, mm-hmm. you know, we'll acquire business, and as they should. I mean, a lot of business owners are very proud of what they built. They're proud of their legacy. In some cases, it's a family name that they want to maintain or just a name that does have real significance and meaning in that local market. So great example. We acquired a phenomenal business in Hawaii. Which was a fun due diligence process.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, like I had a lot of people signing up like, hey, can I help out? And you guys need any more folks to travel with you?
Right.
Like just carry your bags maybe. So Pacific Pipe's name of the company, run by just a fantastic individual, Ken Oda, with a wonderful team there. And we knew very early on that the culture in Hawaii is almost like doing business in a foreign country, right? It's there's just the unique culture and customs that they have there. So we spent a lot of time up front really trying to understand that. We actually hired an outside firm to help us to understand that culture because, again, the culture piece is so critical.
Right.
Unfortunately, you know, despite the differences, I mean, it's all about taking care of the people and treating them like family. And it really meshed with our culture and our organization. So that part was phenomenal.
Well, the neighbor did Demolition Derby. He knew that I kind of liked it. I like going to the shows and watching it. So he asked me to build him a bumper. Well, I got on and I got all cut out. And I was like, well, I'm going to make a couple more of these.
Did he come to you with a, like, did you know enough already? Like, you knew exactly what he was talking about?
No, I had no idea.
Did he show you a picture, hand you some plans?
Showed me a picture, and there's some files out there that everyone in the industry uses.
Okay.
But nobody can change them. Everyone only wants to deal with the files. So it's one size kind of fits all. And so I went in, and I was like, I want to make something different. There's six different styles that I started out with. And I was just going to build one of each style and take it to the show and sell out and be done. Make a little bit of money on it.
So just so like we're all on the same page, typically you think about a bumper as something that is maybe plastic, maybe dents a little. You know, it's kind of just to ease the impact in some way. It's a bumper.
Yeah. No,
I want everyone to think about the front of an old steam locomotive. Okay, this thing is not about softening anything. Okay, this is a weapon.
These are, most of them are fully 3/8 thick bumpers. And there's a grid in there that's every 3 inches going all across the bumper, horizontal and vertical. Okay. So there's no way that these are denting, being bent.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had my first one break. It sheared off.
Were you in tears or happened?
It was kind of funny because there's a lot of other competitors out there that build these bumpers, but this car was up against one of my own bumpers.
On top of that, of course, the main goal is to develop, like I said, confidence in the backcountry, not just like, you know, pull up a car and drop it down in Glacier Basin in Colorado and have a good time. But like, hey, you got to go out, set up your tent, know how to cook, know how to plan for that, know how to read a map, know how to orient a map, blah, blah, blah. I mean, a plethora of different outdoor skills. But they base it around leadership, you know. Mm-hmm. We would have different days where you were in charge and the instructor was there, but they didn't say a word. And if you fucked up, you got to figure it out. And we paid for it a couple times. But those are some of the moments that I really took from that, being like, shit, they didn't just tell you to be a leader. They forced you into either sink or swim. You know?
Your team staring at you.
Yeah.
They're like,
they're like,
where to?
What do we do? Go to that mountain over there. Ow. Yeah. I'm lost, you know? People get upset and you got to work. How do you communicate with someone who is pissed off? And how do you bring everyone down to a lower tempo and not be like, motherfucker, you took us the wrong way? And how to also take accountability for the mistakes that you make. I think that's a really big one that myself needed to learn and a few of these other guys needed to learn. Yeah, so there was
that's we all at one time or another, you know, that's something I think everybody who I think has you know, anything more than kind of baseline ambition to do things has also an Achilles of wanting to be right to a degree.
Yeah,
and whether we're 5 or we're 25, at some point you got to be like, well, I guess I can be wrong. Fuck.
As an estimator, just being able to, you know, sometimes you have those quick hitter quotes. You
right.
know, I don't have 2 hours to wait on pricing back.
Yeah.
You go on Brazos, you type it in, and immediately.
Yeah.
I can type it in my takeoff and be done. So,
nice.
Yeah,
nice.
Very convenient.
Have you found, is that in your like line of work specific with the jobs that you're quoting, being able to respond to bids in a quick manner like that, do you think that gives you any advantage to maybe winning jobs?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. With our business, we do a lot of really custom you know, metals. You know, we're capable of structural, but typically it's the custom one-off stuff. And so, you know, you got guys bidding it, and then they realize, oh, this metal people that are doing all the structural aren't doing this, you know, last thing. And so they invite us, and the bid's due in 2 days.
I see. Gotcha.
But
yeah. Nice. And then generally speaking, are you using Brazos more just for estimating or both estimating and purchasing? Or
so I also use it for purchasing. I always check Brazos pricing when I'm going out for quote. And, compare. I use that to compare. So.
Yeah,
but it was kind of amazing there. But you know, but yeah, so you it's super freaky. I mean, when you're the craziest thing I think was dissecting the eye and the hand. Those were the two things, besides the privates, but the those were the two things that you're just like, holy shit, you can't help but look at your own hand and think about this and your eye, and it's freakish, you know? It's what we were just talking before we got on this, though, about the idea of there's a reason why you can't spend too much time thinking about your death, right? And what is the meaning of all this? And that happens for the surgeons for sure, especially in orthopedics. But yeah, when you stare at your hand and you've done that dissection, and you know what those little – what the pulleys are and what the flexor tendon looks like, it's
there's it, a lot it, of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it makes your head start spinning, and then you just have to kind of wash it out. Yeah.
It takes literally under a minute from the time I can get the material information from you and then putting a PO in and getting it back and getting it done.
Mm-hmm.
It's a game changer.
So is it fair to say that what could have taken 60 minutes to 90 minutes is now being done in a matter of minutes?
Yes.
That's okay. So yes. I'm not.
No.
That makes me so happy. I can't tell you because
you guys have created this, and it is a game changer because of the items that you guys carry. We know that they're out there, but you've made it possible for us to take that time and condense it down into mere seconds.
Okay, so you're managing and probably wishing you were still welding.
There are definitely days where I'd go in and ask, can I just grind on this piece of pipe for a little bit?
Well, management's great until people get involved.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
You know, a kind of, you know, that changes things.
It does.
But you grew into it.
Yeah, you know, I think, again, kind of going back to the law enforcement stuff, you know, skills you learn as far as being able to manage people and read people and understand them and try and look at things through different perspectives, you know, helps with a lot of that. So
you had kind of a good toolkit for this.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Going into it.
Yeah.
And so you've been in management since that time. So we're talking 07, 08-ish.
Yep.
Right. So you've been in the management world doing that.
Correct.
And so we're in St. Louis now, and you were in Illinois, and then so you've ended up in. Did Gross Mechanical bring you to St. Louis, or you'd already been here?
No, I still live in Illinois. I live in Edwardsville area,
okay.
But
I kind of have like two-ish philosophies that are kind of the baseline, and this is like, you know, the thing that I tell my kids over and over again until they're like ad nauseum. One of them is you can either be one of two people in life. You can either be a person who solves problems or a person who points them out, which, you know, leads to an actual binary. It's like you either solve the problem or it's just like, like you move on with life.
Is there a third kind?
No, because
the ones that create the problem.
Everybody creates problems.
But in a given context of like, you know, if you had three different people in a room, would you say, well, that one sort of creates the problem. That one sort of let me know. And, you know, this person is the one who's likely to solve it.
So between those three people, two of them just pointed out a problem.
Right.
So, like, everybody creates problems. Like, I create my own problems. I create problems for other people. You create
so
problems for
ubiquitous.
Yourself.
It's universal. Yeah.
So, like, if everybody is
but
going to create an issue.
Given that constant of problem creation, in the face of that, there are people who point them out and people who solve them.
And, and even in short-term and long-term history, nobody's going to be remembered as the person that said, hey, that thing over there needs to be fixed. It's like, right. You know, the people who care about, you know, the people who care about you or the people, you know, the person who you care about becoming is the one who's going to solve problems. And, you know, you can't just like sit there and depend on somebody else to solve all of your own problems too.
What is a business?
All right. Well, I am not a philosophical student of this. I'm sure there are like pages and pages of academic material on this that I haven't read, but if I just try to kind of break this out from the ground up, you know, a business has customers, it has people getting something done, an employee or people working within it, you know, a service or good that that customer wants, and it has some kind of capital being delivered to it, right? Usually in the form of ownership. And so, you know, what is a business? It's something that's taking materials or taking people and delivering a good or service to the marketplace. But I think the more interesting like piece of this for me is like, you know, how we live in a capitalist framework. That's a society I was born into. I've been incredibly fortunate personally. And like that framework allowed my family to build from a business from nothing and like provide more than we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think like in a capitalist framework, like a business is like the critical piece that holds it all together. And like a well-run business that is taking care of its customers and taking care of its team and taking care of its owners, which is really hard to do. I think it's really hard to like balance all three of those.
Say those three again.
It's a great, like great for the employees, great for the customers, and great for ownership.
Okay.
And balancing all three of those at the same time, I think, like I was saying, I think it's really, really difficult to do. I think we glorify a lot of different aspects of it just in the media, and like it's hard to like clean that up and get a clear picture of like how do we get all three of those working effectively. And then I think that in a lot of ways the customer is separate from the owner-labor. I'm going to just call it labor, like the owner-labor relationship. The customer is separate from that, and that's the marketplace. And I always think, like, the marketplace is a cruel master. That's a phrase that lives in my mind. Like the marketplace doesn't give a shit about ownership and customer and employees. It doesn't care about their healthcare. It doesn't care about all the things that
none of it,
you know, impact those employees. Likes to talk about it and cry about them, for sure. Right. But mm-hmm. like at the end of the day, people buy what they buy when they need it for a price that they want to pay for it. And they don't care who's behind it. They don't care what chicken laid the eggs.
No, that's well said. I need fucking eggs.
Yeah. And I love that this conversation is really, you know, really taking that as a foregone conclusion. We're not really talking about waywardness. We're not talking about irresponsibility. We're talking about the room to grow.
Yeah.
You know, and that's for us all.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's entrepreneurs out here that'll watch and hear this and maybe take something away with this comment that I'm going to share with regard to, you know, our mates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can tell you, you know, personally as an entrepreneur, you know, some of my ideas weren't real great. But the passion was there. The commitment was there. The result, not so much. How do you continue to fight for your entrepreneurial independence and the freedom that you need to be able to try things that have never been tried before or try things you've never tried before, right? With the weight of responsibility of a family. Here's your wife that's pregnant with your first child, or you just had a child. Or you have two young children and you're in an apartment and your husband is saying, listen, let's take the last bit of this nest egg and I'm going to buy ostrich eggs. And I really think this ostrich farm is really going to do big things, you know. and we just, I'm telling you, honey, I can just see an ostrich in every yard, you know. And she's like, honey, I love you. And I want to, you know. Ostriches? Come on, don't you believe in me? You know? And I'm reducing it to the ridiculous because what if it wasn't as ridiculous as ostrich eggs, but it was something so unique that it just isn't on every heart and mind yet.
Yeah.
But it has the potential.
So back to this kind of overarching concept of digital. I think that, you know, if we brought 10 people in here and asked them, hey, do you think it's going to go digital? How many do you think would say yes?
All of them.
You think all of them?
I think all of them will. And you can have some resistors. And it also depends on who you're bringing in, I suppose. I mean, the non-digital age is aging out.
So, they really are.
Yeah. And it's funny because you go in a lot of shops, there's not a lot of young people in there, unless it's a really it depends on the industry, but you know, these people are starting to retire. The younger people are coming in. They've already are well versed in the digital age, and so moving that way is bringing. I mean, I would imagine there's young people are coming into some of these companies and saying, "Why are you even doing this?" You know,
I think that's a big part of our thinking, which is, yeah, we brought in the same designers that, you know, do Samsung, Apple, like the best designers for this release we're about to do, because I view it as a bit of a problem that companies in supply chains have trouble attracting talent and retaining talent just because their software systems are just not the latest and greatest, let's say. And not kids, but people who are starting their careers want to be someplace where they feel like they're part of the action and they're using the best and the best things are available to them. And one of my goals has been, like, I want people who thought they wanted to go into some other industry, see what the shit that's coming out our door and be like, I want to be in the metals world.
I agree. And I think that shift has to come. More automation, more digitization.
Yeah.
And that will come.
Yeah.
But we got to push it. We're the generation that has to do that.
It's a benefit to our country to have so many people using it.
Right.
Because it's learning at such a rapid rate.
Yeah. And, you know, here's the right now. I mean, it's kind of amazing, right? It's sort of, in a way, it levels the playing field for businesses. Right. Mm-hmm. It levels the playing field because never before has everybody had such access to open source tools, you know, of this level. But likewise, you know, you do have, you know, organizations that have not unlimited, but that have vast financial resources have the ability to do it even better. Yes. Right. And so while it does level the playing field in some ways, the potential for inequality with these systems is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, the rate at harvest of information and how do you put that information into action is, you know, you could have 20 people mining something versus one, and then they can write programs to, you know, collate all this. And
absolutely.
And they're off to the races.
Yeah.
And so there is going to be such a good thing as good at AI and bad AI.
Yeah. And, you know, the quote is, you know, AI is probably not going to take your job, but the person who knows how to use it is going to take your job.
And so what was your, I think you were talking with Lee
that day.
So what happened when you guys were there?
So walking by, of course, first time at FabTech, taking it all in, realizing how much we're in the dinosaur age with some of our equipment. But I see this little Eleanor Matchbox car, and there was like four or five left, and I just kept eyeballing it, and Lee said, "Hey, man, do you buy material?" And I was like, "Yes."
You're like, maybe.
Does that car come with it? And so he starts explaining to me, you know, and at first I'm like, all right, I'm just going to listen to this spiel. Yeah. I'm going to get that car.
Well, yeah, just talk at me for a few minutes, and I'm walking away.
But then as he started talking, I was like, oh, shit. I can recall sometimes I'd send out an email for material pricing. It may be a couple days before I get anything back. And at that point, I'm, you know, on to the next project and stuff like that. But, yeah, it was something simple. I needed, you know, at the time I had a job that I had not ordered the material for.
Mm-hmm.
We typed it up, real-life pricing, and it was almost $20 a joint less than what I was getting quoted from my normal suppliers.
It probably got your attention.
Absolutely.
Pretty quickly. And I'm going from memory, but didn't you spot, you spot checked as you called?
Oh, yeah.
Your buyer?
Yeah, I did. I saw it and I was like,
standing right there, because I think I was probably looking for merch from someone else, and I walked up kind of as that was occurring.
I was like, there's no way. I was like, this just can't be. I'm like, they probably got these numbers fudged just to promote this thing or whatever. Right. But I make a phone call and I call my rep and I was like, hey, yada, yada, yada. She was like, no, this is what I can do it at. And I'm like, so you can't do it at this price? No. I was like, all right, thanks. And right then and there, I was like, okay, I need to place an order. I mean, because I had the job already in the shop. So yeah. I knew it was coming. And ever since then, yeah, it's just the real-time pricing and just being able to order it.